Chapter 7. Advertising Ourselves to Death. Click a button and we can read the New York Times or watch our favorite TV show or stream the latest movie. Submit a query to Google and a world of knowledge appears on the screen, albeit algorithmically delimited. Newspaper or magazine, TV or movie, fact, tidbit, or commentary, no matter how big or small, how significant or trivial, it's all available at our fingertips, and it's all absolutely free. This is the perception we have been lulled into believing. It is time to wake up. There is no free lunch, free movie, news report, or factoid. We are paying, and paying dearly. We pay with our time and our attention, a scarce and valuable resource in the 21st century, and the coin of the realm in today's attention economy. We pay by being forced to engage with what has become an unending stream of advertising, blurred to be indistinguishable from legitimate news stories, leading to the utter skewing of our sense of reality. We pay by providing our personal data to marketers, who then use that data to sell us an increasing array of products specifically targeted to us, by manipulating and whipsawing our emotions. We pay by turning our relationships into monetizable opportunities, making personal interactions into market transactions, and remaining in a constant state of buying or selling, albeit one that's been prettied up to look like sharing and making friends. Exaggeration? I don't think so. Not if dating apps like Tinder exist that allow us to dismiss people with a swipe of a thumb, or apps like People are created with the sole purpose to rate anyone, anytime, without their say, as if they were a plate of food or a room to rent from Airbnb. No matter where we turn in this digitally enhanced world, our agency, our personal ability to act freely and independently, is being quashed. We can't choose the type of content we want to watch or read. We can't represent who we are. We are emotionally manipulated in the name of corporate profit. This is what marketers call consumer empowerment. I heartily disagree. Until now, we could be excused for passively interacting with whatever content appears on our mobile device or laptop. Few beyond those working in the industry knew or understood the level of stealth activity associated with digital technologies, and many of them don't even comprehend it. I sympathize. I'm not a Luddite, but I'm not a tech person either. It all seems too complex and confusing, and ultimately overwhelming. In truth, it was designed that way. You see, we've been duped, and by some really smart people. Jeff Hammerbacker, Facebook's first research scientist and a Harvard-trained mathematician, is widely quoted as saying, "The best minds of my generation are thinking about how to make people click ads, and it sucks." It's the reason he left the company. But tricking us into clicking on ads certainly doesn't happen only on Facebook, and manipulation doesn't happen only at the level of content. The user interface keeps our eyes locked and our hands glued to the screens, big and small. In 1996, B.J. Fogg, another smart guy, this time from Stanford University, coined the term captology, based on an acronym for Computers as Persuasive Technologies. His work, which has been embraced by numerous companies, uses a combination of tools to increase our interaction with a screen. These are positive or negative motivation, pleasure or pain, ability, simplified tasks, and triggers, say a noise cue. So every time a push notification comes through our phone, we leap from whatever we are doing to pick it up, typically in anticipation of a pleasurable reward, like a text from a loved one. Of course, it is more likely to be a come-on from a corporation. But once we've been triggered to pick up the phone, we're hooked. And so we end up clicking and clicking, creating endless data and interacting with untold ads every day. And most of the time, we're painfully unaware that that is what we are doing. It is utterly Pavlovian. Combine that addictive technology with ambiguous information, and we have content confusion writ large. As bad as all this is, it's about to get worse. The media industry as we know it is imploding. Advertising and agency. There has long been a tacit agreement media companies had with their audiences. If we sit through the commercials, the networks will provide us with high-quality news and entertainment. Barring that, we buy a monthly subscription to programming like HBO or Showtime in order to avoid having to deal with commercials. While many of us complained about this structure, in truth, it wasn't that bad. Commercials may be irrelevant to you or inane in their execution, but some are incredibly entertaining, such as Apple's 1984, Budweiser's What's Up, Nike's Michael Jordan ads, and more recently, VW's Darth Vader and Old Spice's The Man Your Man Could Smell Like. It doesn't get much better than Under Armour's Misty Copeland ad. Smart, captivating, strategically aligned advertising is typically so good that you want to watch it. And if you don't, you can always get up and grab a beer, or go to the bathroom, or walk the dog. In this scenario, no company knew in any detail who you were, or what you watched, or what you bought. You might see some advertising that didn't relate directly to you, but so what? More importantly, you knew it was a commercial, and it was your choice whether or not to watch it. At the beginning of the internet, the high social ideal was that it would somehow exist outside this revenue model. In the boom days before the internet bubble, and even after, company business plans were drawn up without a hint of how the organization was going to generate income. Facebook is a great example here in that they didn't try to make money for almost 6 years, yet they still had millions of dollars of investment capital. It was a cyberspace gold rush, but no one knew what they were mining. Making money ultimately came down to two things: sell stuff, e-commerce, or sell time and space, advertising. Subscription models like Netflix or Hulu didn't take off until later, when broadband became widely available, and ultimately they qualify as e-commerce too. When the dust finally settled, the internet turned out to be no different than the legacy media that preceded it. The internet, and with it, every mobile device we carry, no matter where we go, no matter what we do, is nothing more than a purveyor of sales messages. Your phone is an advertising medium. So, the advertising model you hated on television now exists online, only it's worse. While you might not have liked commercials breaking up your favorite TV show, ads now follow you around the internet instead, moving from your computer to your iPad to your cell phone. Along the way, myriad companies are collecting more and more data about you without your even knowing it, though you may suspect it is happening and don't like it. And the advertising is no longer obvious, so you're never quite sure if you're getting news or some sort of biased claptrap. With TV, you were anonymous, and you knew when you were watching a commercial. Not anymore. Today, that cute animal video might be an ad for a mobile phone company, and that article about cocaine use turns out to be an ad for Netflix. Of course, commercials have long been manipulative and designed to pull at our heartstrings, but we knew we were being manipulated. Today, our emotional world is up for grabs, so that we will do the labor of sharing commercial messages with our friends. While we grumble about commercials, the truth is that advertising was and still is the economic support for all the music and entertainment and news we have come to want and need. It isn't free, and it never was, no matter how much it feels like it is. But we'll get to the point, and we're getting close to it, when media outlets can't sell enough advertising to support the content they need to create. That's not just an issue for traditional media. Ad blockers, browser extensions that prevent ads from being loaded onto your screen, may become so pervasive as to threaten the existence of online outlets. Ad blockers have been around for a while, but only recently achieved wide acceptance, in no small part due to their ability to improve download times, because the browser doesn't have to spend resources on delivering ads. Around the globe, 41% of internet users block ads, and that number is growing. This latest, greatest means of ad avoidance seems great for us, but it may destroy the advertising-based revenue model as more and more money moves to digital. Once there isn't enough advertising income to support media companies, their only alternative is to charge us for every manner of content. It's already started with HBO Now, CBS All Access, Netflix, Hulu, and so on and so on and so on. It's also why Google and Apple and Amazon have all gotten into TV, and why Amazon is preventing its competitors from selling TV products on their site. Most telling is the sales pitch for Apple TV, which reads in part, "TV is a major part of our lives, yet somehow the overall experience of TV has continued to stagnate. Until now, it all starts by recognizing that apps are the future of television. HBO Now, Watch ESPN, Netflix, Hulu, iTunes, apps are quickly becoming how we watch today. This is where television is headed." TV equals apps, and apps equal money coming out of your pocket. Soon, very soon, that $150 a month cable bill is going to start looking pretty sweet in comparison to all the individual subscriptions we'll have to buy because we didn't want to know we were looking at advertising. Advertising Age calculated what that possible ad-free media universe might look like. A subscription to the New York Times would increase from $195 a year to $334 a year. Television would cost about $1,800 a year, $1,200 without premium channels like HBO, for at most a dozen TV channels, rather than the 500-channel universe you are used to, because those networks could no longer afford to exist. And Facebook would cost $12 a year. They also noted that the fee for BuzzFeed would be zero, because no one would pay for that content. And a world without advertising is a world without BuzzFeed. The ad-free media universe posits a reversion to the times of early newspapers, when the only people who could afford access to information were the wealthy. It is a world for the one percenters. Given this doomsday scenario, I am all for watching TV with commercials, knowing full well they are commercials, and paying for advertising-free online content. I'd pay to use Google. It's a valuable service. If at some later time I decide that its algorithms are too out of whack, I might change my mind. But let us all decide for ourselves. And at the risk of sounding like a libertarian, let the market decide. Given the choice, $12 a year for Facebook is a pittance in comparison to the price we pay in personal data, skewed reality, and dehumanized personal relationships. Too big to fail. The boys of Silicon Valley were smart enough to bleed the media system. They weren't smart enough to create a better revenue model than the advertising one that preceded it. E-commerce rates only as a minor innovation. Google and Facebook both claimed, no, bragged vociferously, that they would not be purveyors of advertising. That would be funny if it wasn't so sad and dangerous and deceptive. Their cleverness may yet come back to bite them, and we could end up paying the bill. But for now, the four horsemen of tech, Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Apple, just keep on with their deceptive and monopolistic practices. Google has become the biggest advertising platform, and with that status has come bullying tactics. In April 2015, for instance, the company changed its search algorithm for mobile because, as we know, mobile is the future. Any advertiser that hadn't made their site mobile-friendly enough for Google found themselves losing the advertising bid. So what, you might say? After all, that only affects the companies. Not so. Google was giving higher search result rankings to sites with large text, easy-to-click links, or those with responsive design, the last meaning a site whose webpage URL was consistent across devices. Sites from eBay to Nintendo to the Daily Mail got lost in the search rankings. When one company controls that much gatekeeper power, they have untold ability not only to affect other companies' bottom line, but also our ability to access information. Facebook, too, is immersed in advertising and commerce, including selling news. In October 2015, they finally launched their long-awaited instant articles, news stories from leading publications like the New York Times, the Washington Post, National Geographic, and The Atlantic, among others. Dozens more are slated to join, with the real possibility that very soon, every digital publisher, journalistic or non, that wants to be a serious online player will host a large portion of their content on Facebook's servers. While the service is touted for its faster downloads, the real reason news organizations have signed on is so that they can get a piece of Facebook's advertising revenue. Some publishers will outsource their advertising sales to Facebook, but others, mostly the larger entities, will sell their own advertising, some of which will be the native variety. The most obvious and ubiquitous way that Facebook displays its commitment to all things commercial is the Like button. After announcing that the company would respond to users' request for a Dislike button, Zuckerberg came back with a series of emotional options, without a Dislike button among them. Few industry followers were surprised. Dislike is anti-advertising. What Facebook did come up with was a series of emoticons, which helps Facebook and advertisers more than it helps you. While the Like button says that you accept being associated with a brand, Susie Smith likes XYZ company, emoticons move feelings, and we know how important those are, from verbiage to structured data. It is deceptive, systemized emotional tracking from the company that brought you Emotional Contagion experiments. They are also the company that enables other companies to evaluate your social connections to determine your ability to get a loan, to target you for military service, and to assess your job qualifications. How long do you think it will be before you hit the sad emoticon one too many times and an antidepressant medication ends up in your newsfeed? The manipulative and monopolistic practices of Google and Facebook are reflected on the e-commerce side at Amazon. This online shopping site is now a behemoth and the leading search option when it comes to shopping, with 44% of people starting on the site when they purchase online. With size comes power, which the company uses to bully other companies. Notable here are the almost year-long price-setting fight with publisher Hachette, and the announcement that Amazon had banned the sale of streaming devices from its key competitors, Apple and Google. As Amazon moves into more and more businesses, there is every reason to believe that these practices will continue. And we know that they are going into lots of different businesses. They spend billions of dollars annually in research and development to come up with things like delivery drones and electronics like the Kindle and Fire TV. And most recently, they have taken on retailers in a handful of cities like New York, San Francisco, and San Antonio by offering one-hour delivery through Amazon Prime Now, which threatens not big competitors, but little mom-and-pop stores. Lastly, Amazon has become notorious for its reportedly abysmal labor practices, which affects employees from temporary warehouse help to white-collar workers. But all we see is the convenience, the box with a smile on our doorstep. What we don't see are the overworked people and the monopolistic practices that deny us access to products. Nor are we privy to how they track our data, from what we buy right down to how much we read and what we highlight on our Kindle. Providing the foundation for and fueling the perpetuation of triggers and clicks is, of course, Apple. They make the technology, sure, but they also distribute content via iTunes and Apple TV and collect purchase data through Apple Pay, which is tying in with an untold number of brick-and-mortar retail outlets. We can only begin to guess how they will combine what we watch to what we buy to who we text in new and more hidden ways. What concerns me more at this point is that they are on the cutting edge of supporting ad blocking. This is great for them, because they primarily generate revenue from products rather than advertising. but for us, again, it has costs. As I have discussed throughout the book, there have always been ways to avoid advertising. What Apple is doing, per B.J. Fogg's methodology, is to make the task simpler by allowing developers to create ad-blocking tools for its new iOS 9 operating system. Now that Apple has gotten into the fight, the expectation is that ad blockers will gain still broader acceptance. The immediate issue for us, ad blockers don't detect content marketing. So either we will not know we are engaging with ads because we will have assumed that ad blockers caught the advertising, or the advertising will become even more black ops in order to avoid being detected by ad blockers. In the long term, they may be the avoidance tool that sinks the entire advertising-based media system. In thinking about these companies, I couldn't help but remember when I began teaching media, and we used to show students an illustration of an octopus with tentacles wrapped around the logos of the major media companies like Disney and Viacom and News Corp. Now, that octopus looks downright quaint in comparison to the subversive digital techno behemoths. Those legacy media were regulated in a way that today's media giants simply are not. And while Disney might be vertically integrated, producing TV shows and games based on films, which in turn get syndicated onto the Disney Channel, today's media companies are also increasingly horizontally integrated, so that their tentacles reach into more and more industries. Google makes cars and maps, Apple has Apple Pay, Amazon creates drones, and all of them sell data, with Facebook being the most encompassing because of its ability to interconnect people, whether they are on the site or not. Instead of the banks, it will be Facebook and Google and Amazon and Apple who have become too big to fail. And it won't be just one industry, but several that will take the fall. We are not there yet. In the meantime, there is other fallout from digital technologies and advertising we need to address. Content consequences. Throughout the book, we've discussed ways in which content is deceptive. Native advertising hides commercial messages in existing content. Content marketing turns product placement on its head, forcing legitimate information to find a home within corporately sponsored material. And while marketers claim their expertise, which is true, they also claim journalistic objectivity, which is not. Finally, content has to be engaging to keep our attention and motivate us to share. So, content creators will gear more content to be entertaining, making serious news increasingly harder to find. Dependence on big data is only making it worse. Big data is concerned with behavior, not context. What this means is that digital advertisers don't care what we watch, context. They simply care what we do, behavior. Since advertisers care primarily about reaching us as far down the sales funnel as possible, then the content the advertising appears in is superfluous. It is utterly disconnected from the ad buy. Let me explain. Traditional media models were all about aggregating eyeballs for advertisers. Marketers made educated guesses about who was watching what TV programming. Today, companies are chasing individuals, or individual IP addresses, and they have a very good idea of who each individual is. Based on this, advertising is sent instantly to wherever you are on the web. You could be reading the news, watching cat videos, or taking a pop quiz. In this environment, the content simply doesn't matter. If the content doesn't matter, there is no incentive to produce anything of substance, or something that might take time or money, say, like investigative reporting. I often tell students that the TV networks would show a test pattern if they thought people would watch it. We won't do that for TV. On the internet, though, we come pretty close. There are numerous examples of wasted resources throughout this book, but the one that tops the list is a website called www.blahairlines.com. It is a stripped-down, downscale version of a typical airline website. Its most outstanding feature is an alert on the bottom of the page that says, "Breaking news on a video you should not watch." Ultimately, you will be taken to a 5-hour and 45-minute video, really, of a bunch of dummies in seats for a supposed flight from New York to San Francisco. The video is not static. There is audio of babies crying. A flight attendant gives the usual announcements. And periodically, someone off-screen manipulates a dummy's arm as if to move hair out of her face. I'm not sure which boggles the mind more, that Virgin Airlines spent the time and money and energy to produce this, or that more than 850,000 people viewed it. Another example of disjointed content is the No website, no.com, consisting of a single page with a picture of Darth Vader and a button you can push that says No. This site, a single page, really, has received more than 27 million views, has 673,000 Facebook likes, and has been tweeted more than 75,000 times, thus qualifying as suitable for advertising placement. If the content isn't inane or ridiculous, it veers towards stunts like Mark Echo pretending to tag Air Force One, or a story of a naked man crawling out of a Buckingham Palace window, which was covered by NBC News only for the network to be embarrassed to learn that it was a stunt for a show called The Royals that appears on one of its own networks. That's right, a media company's marketing team created fake news that was picked up by its real news division. Underlying all of this are the economic consequences of moving revenue out of traditional media and into digital marketing, including lost jobs, lower pay, and evergreen content. Many of the people writing content marketing today are former journalists who can no longer find a position because newspapers are dead or dying. These writers, who can very skillfully make an ad look like news, have no choice because marketers are becoming the only ones with enough money to pay a decent wage. Even given that, many of these skilled writers are working as freelancers rather than full-time salaried employees. Maintaining freelancers is one way for a company to keep costs in check. The other common practice is to use evergreen content, content that is not tied to a particular point in time, meaning that it can be used over and over again. Remember, the goal is to distribute content that people will read. Online, you can constantly be getting new people in front of content, which you can't do with a newspaper that has subscribers or loyal folks that pick up the paper at the newsstand every day. The problem for writers, then, is that once there is a stockpile of content that can be continually repurposed, there is less need for writers. Don't forget, too, the increasing amount of written content that is produced for free, read Huffington Post, and videos produced as user-generated content. In the latter case, it won't just be writers out of jobs, but all the creative people in agencies, including art directors, copywriters, producers, casting directors, and the dozens of more junior people who report to them. And if this continues to play out, many personnel at television networks will be out of work too. Newspapers and broadcasters comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, confronting us with issues we must face. They investigate corrupt politicians, report on the local school board meetings, and discover the source of tainted food when the government doesn't spend the money to do so. If it were not for newspapers and local broadcasters, we would likely never have known about Watergate, Washington Post, or the AIDS epidemic, San Francisco Chronicle, or the financial improprieties of RNC chairman Michael Steele, WBAL. Who's going to do those stories online? The Drudge Report? BuzzFeed? Personal consequences. You're just an old-time marketer. That's what one of the people I interviewed said to me. In fact, he said it as if I was scum he'd found on the bottom of his shoe. Truth is, he's right. I am an old-time marketer. And because of that, I didn't, and still don't, see what all the fuss is about when it comes to using digital technologies as a marketing tool. Digital isn't magical, it's advertising. And our cell phones and mobile devices aren't mechanisms of wonder, they are an advertising distribution system. Sure, the gizmos and gadgets of our mobile devices are fun, and for marketers, it's nice to see sales numbers grow and to use big data to generate pretty colorful graphs. But an ad medium is an ad medium is an ad medium. I really couldn't get all that excited about it. What bothered me, though, was how excited the people I interviewed seemed about things like A-B testing, putting two pictures up online to see which one will generate more sales, and tracking people around the internet in pursuit of data, all without people knowing they are participating in ongoing, unpaid market research. Being able to look at this from the outside, what I could see that most people I interviewed could not, or would not admit to seeing, were the serious consequences of all this stealth activity. People who work in advertising say things like, more information means better targeting so that ads are more relevant for consumers. Or market testing is just about making the online product better. Or content marketing is less disruptive and more entertaining. They also say that consumers aren't stupid, that consumers can see that the work they produce is advertising. Not so. In presenting parts of this book over the last year, the audible gasps that come up in the room are evidence that people don't know, and that includes classrooms full of millennial college students, the ones who are supposed to be so hip to this information. Content confusion is real. The skewing of reality is real. The social media feeding this subversive content has its own negative hidden agenda. We already know that sharing is about buying and selling. We also know that our relationships have become market transactions. But that's not all. Just as women feel inferior after reading magazines, the same is true online, only we find ourselves competing with friends rather than some unattainable model. Statistics are that 1/3 of Facebook users feel envious of others and worse about themselves after leaving the site. That is because confessionalism, exhibitionism, prideful consumerism, and above all, a relentless positivity are the values and practices of today's social media. We feel compelled to constantly project a positive image, even if that image has no basis in reality. Take the examples of Kirsten Rickenback-Cerveny, a stunning, successful Long Island doctor found dead of a drug overdose in the vestibule of a New York City apartment building, and Madison Holleran, the Ivy League track star who leapt to her death from a 9-story parking garage. Both were beautiful and smart and successful by any measure. Both led double lives, with the online life projecting an all-too-perfect world that no one could ever possibly live up to, not in a million years. These are extreme, for sure, but the pressures to fit in are not. But we can understand why this happens. The rules of advertising, everything has to look good, everything has to be perfect, everything is not real, have spilled over onto sites that were originally meant for community, but that are now all about commerce. The online space becomes the storefront for our own personal brands, which in turn sell the clothes we wear and the stores we shop and the bars we frequent. We become walking, talking advertisements. In thinking about this, it suddenly struck me why the pitch for the new iPhone was primarily all about the camera. The better the camera, the better able we are to make products look good. Our world is further skewed by the manipulation of data. Data collected about us can be inadequate or flat out wrong. It limits who we are because it is derived from what we did, not who we might become. It is the difference between Amazon offering suggestions for books and going to the library to see what's on the shelf. Algorithms that generate this data are a black box, and they are not neutral. It's possible that companies might make good use of the personal data we're providing, but there's no way for us to know everything that's involved in the process of collecting it and using it. I've outlined much of that process in this book, but even that can only begin to skim the surface. The sad reality is that we don't know, and from my research, I've found that even marketers don't fully understand what happens with all the information we provide by living our lives increasingly online. Finally, because we are increasingly tethered to technology, we live increasingly mediated lives rather than engaging with the world. The marimba ringtone makes every head turn. We step on an elevator and pull out our cell phones instead of talking to one another. If there is a phone on a table, personal conversations or conversations of depth are less likely to come up. In her latest book, MIT professor Sherry Turkle outlines how millennials have determined an appropriate etiquette for when you can pull out a cell phone when among a group of people. She notes as well that boredom for this generation has become a fate worse than death. They are not alone. Ask a friend, "How are you?" and the response is likely to be "busy." We should ask ourselves why that has become a badge of honor, why we have become too busy to engage with each other. Some of that is economic, but technology has culpability here too. We are more willing to engage with advertising, because that's what we are doing if we're online, than with the living, breathing person standing next to us. It is madness. Where's the good? It's not in my nature to be a pessimist. In thinking about these issues, though, I'm not sure that I have what could qualify as a neatly packaged solution. The best I can do is to provide some insights and suggestions. First, I like really good, smart advertising. The GE moon landing piece with Thrillist fits that bill. Intel's inside films are gorgeously executed. Whole Foods has a blog called Whole Story that is beautiful and contains informative content. As long as these ads are clearly marked, as far as I'm concerned, it's all good. Having listened to this book, my hope is that you can more easily spot the advertisements on your own, but you should not have to do all the work. The FTC has held meetings with members of the advertising industry and given them veiled threats, but to little avail. That lack of action, along with the sense I got from speaking with someone at the agency, makes me believe that the organization doesn't have teeth, even with their new guidelines. An alternative route should be found. As the FTC guidelines suggest, advertising needs to be clearly marked using a consistent language. When it says sponsored content, we should know that it means advertising. This should not merely be guidelines, but full-fledged regulation with consequences attached. Implementing this should not be hard to put into place. As for tracking, government regulations already prohibit the Marine Corps websites from using cookies. How about we apply that regulation to all online advertising, while providing enough flexibility in the language to cover whatever new technology comes along when cookies soon become obsolete? Second, there are a lot of really good uses for data collection, and I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But accumulating data on how to better target us for ads doesn't make the top 10. Believing that big data allows correlation, connections between events happening concurrently, to trump causation, one event causing another, also doesn't make the cut. Nor does misleading people on dating sites, a skeevy tool that I would rank up with the conversion tactics of religious cults. Instead, smart, life-affirming data analysis and positive uses for technology are happening outside the realm of advertising and marketing, and we should look to them for inspiration. One example is the work of Crisis Text Line, or CTL, the first 24-hour hotline via text. Because it is text-based and data-driven, the organization has been able to develop an understanding of what issues teens are facing, cutting, depression, eating disorders, and when crises are most likely to occur. Sunday is the day of the week when they get the most texts about suicide, for example, and uses that to better serve those in need. In another example, ProPublica has a website called Dollars for Docs, that allows people to search for payments made by pharmaceutical companies to doctors and hospitals in order to suss out underlying biases. As for technology itself, cell phones enable personal freedom for young Saudis by providing a space for debates on Twitter, flirting on Snapchat, and business opportunities on Instagram, which would be verboten in the real world. Even the much-maligned drone can be used for good, as they have been in the service of transporting medical supplies around the world. This is what the best minds of this generation should be working on, not getting us to click on another ridiculous, time-wasting ad. Third, individual actions to repel technology are good, but they won't turn the tide. More and more of my friends have begun to take Facebook vacations. This turns out to be quite common. In 2013, Pew Research found that 61% of Americans have at one time or another in the past voluntarily taken a break from using Facebook for a period of several weeks or more. People use the term digital detox, and we would do well to adopt this strategy. There's also something called conscious computing, some of which is ridiculous because it involves wearing technology to remind you to stop using technology. But some advice is useful, such as only looking at your email at defined times during the day. These types of individual changes in the digital space are fine, but it's like recycling and the environment. Every little bit helps, but only collective action, not individual choices, will affect the system and the techno-behemoths. Standard Oil was the innovator of its day, but the Supreme Court saw fit to order its breakup in 1911. We should do no less with Google and Amazon and Apple and Facebook. We might also add Uber and Airbnb to that list. Additional regulations should address issues such as the right to be forgotten, where search engines are required to delete information that is no longer relevant or is misrepresentative. This policy is the law in Europe. Many have argued that there are free speech issues at play. That's ridiculous. The press in the United States is protected by the First Amendment, but it can still be taken to task for libel. This is no different. Silicon Valley clings to some long-forgotten notion that the digital space is open source and free. It is not, and it needs to be regulated like the mature business that it is. I'm not particularly optimistic when it comes to data and our privacy. That cat's already out of the bag. However, there are things you can do to reduce your online presence or to help be more aware of how and when you are being tracked. I use a number of ad blockers, but I use them for detection rather than for blocking purposes. Seeing 6,697 requests for information about me when I went on Salon.com made me disconcerted enough to think about whether that's a site I will visit again anytime soon. Ghostery and Disconnect are easy to add to your browser, and both help you see who's tracking you. Ad Detector lets you know when a news article is really an advertisement, which is terrifically useful for spotting content marketing. Tor, TrackMeNot, and AdBlocker or AdBlocker Plus were all recommended during my research as tools to get control over the tracking and advertising that we cannot see. Be aware, however, that an increasing number of sites will not allow access to their content if you don't agree to see the ads. In truth, that's not so bad. At least you know what you are looking at. If we continue on the current trajectory, confusion, manipulation, and obfuscation will only get worse. Independent media voices will be overtaken by marketers, who will be the only ones left who can afford to pay for content, leaving us with a warped perception of reality. Sites we think of as places of entertainment and personal interaction will have been transformed into shopping malls. Eliminating digital technologies is unrealistic. Eliminating the corporations that have a chokehold on the system is not. Until that happens, we can become more aware, and through awareness, we can increase our agency. Some of that will come through downsizing our digital life and enabling ad detectors that help us to better understand the content we are engaging with. Some will come from remembering this one thing. Your mobile device is a purveyor of advertising, no more, no less, and it exists to keep us in a constant state of buying and selling. We need to stop thinking about digital technology as something scary and hidden and complex. It's not complex. It's incredibly simple. Every time you go online, you are giving a piece of yourself away. Every time you go online, you are not interacting with a single site, but with a plethora of marketers, all trying to sell you something. Every time you go online, you are exposing yourself to content that has no basis in reality. Real empowerment comes from refusing to be a consumer of content or of anything else. Maybe instead of pulling out your phone when you step on an elevator, you could start a conversation with the person standing next to you, or maybe you could just be bored. If we don't do that, we might just advertise ourselves to death. Now you know. This has been an Audible Studios production of Black Ops Advertising, Native Ads, Content Marketing, and the Covert World of the Digital Cell, written by Mara Einstein, performed by Tamara Marston, producer Mike Charzik, copyright 2016 by Mara Einstein, production copyright 2016 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.